we resume our meeting and we're going to discuss implementation issues. Katrina?
Good afternoon. So it's the agenda papers 12. I'm going to start with agenda paper 12, which is the IFRIC update from the May meeting. You'll notice there was a very short interpretations committee in May. That meeting was not an in-person meeting, it was a sort of video and telephone meeting with the committee. There was just one topic discussed, and actually you may have thought, oh, why still hold a meeting if there was just one topic to discuss? But in this instance, because the topic related to IFRS 9, we felt there was a benefit in having the committee talk about this question in the public domain sort of sooner rather than later. So we held a meeting, and as you can see, the committee reached a tentative agenda decision. The particular question was in relation to asking whether particular financial instruments are eligible for the election in IFRS 9 to present changes in fair value and other comprehensive income. And in responding to that, the committee observed, of course, that particular presentation election is available only to particular investments in equity instruments. Mm-hmm. And because the particular instruments identified in the submission do not meet the definition of an equity instrument, therefore they concluded that in the context of these particular instruments, that presentation election is not available for the holder of these instruments. So as I say, that's gone out as a tentative agenda decision, which is now subject to subsidiary commentary. I don't know if there are any particular questions on...
No questions?
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, then we'll move on to agenda papers 12A and IFRIC 23. Takashi.
Uncertainty over income tax treatments that plagues us all. So please go ahead.
So agenda paper 12A asks the board to ratify an IFRIC interpretation uncertainty over income tax treatments. The interpretation would add to existing requirements. IAS 12 includes requirements on recognition and measurement on how to account for tax assets and tax liabilities, but does not specifically address how to reflect uncertainty. The committee was informed that entities apply diverse reporting methods when the application of tax law is uncertain. Because of this, the committee decided to develop an interpretation to address how to reflect uncertainty in accounting for income taxes. The committee published the draft interpretation in October 2015 and received 61 comment letters. At its meetings in July and September in 2016, the committee discussed the feedback received and reached agreement on all technical matters. There are no substantive changes from the draft interpretation to the proposed final interpretation. In the light of the feedback received, the committee decided to provide transition relief for those first-time adopters whose date of transition to IFRS is before the date that the interpretation is issued. The interpretation, therefore, includes a consequential amendment to IFRS 1. At its meeting in November 2016, the committee reviewed the due process steps and was satisfied that the due process requirements had been met. The balloting of the interpretation took place in April 2017, and all the committee members agreed to submit the interpretation to the board for ratification. In accordance with the due process handbook, at this meeting, we are asking the board to ratify the interpretation.
So just before handing over to you for discussion, you'll notice that I left on your desk a sheet that's titled Paragraph 11 of post-ballot draft of IFRIC 23. So just to explain, since posting the papers for this meeting, we've identified a small drafting improvement to paragraph 11 of the post-ballot draft, which you can see in your papers is agenda paper 12A, small I. That'll be just put on your desk for observers and for those listening on the webcast. There's not actually an additional paper here because I will now explain what it is that is in front of the board members. So it's in relation to, for again, for those listening, it's on pages 7 and 8 of agenda paper 12A, small I, and it relates to paragraph 11. So paragraph 11, in bullets A and B of paragraph 11, what is mentioned are scenarios when we think that either the most likely amount or the expected value would provide a better protection of the resolution of the uncertainty. In bullet A, it mentions that the most likely amount may better predict the resolution if the possible outcomes are binary. Bullet B goes on to explain that the expected value may better predict that resolution if the possible outcomes are widely dispersed. Now, what was identified, of course, is that you could have binary outcomes mm-hmm. that are widely dispersed. And therefore, the drafting that we had in Agenda Paper 12 I small I could be confusing in that respect. So our suggestion, just to make it clear to you, is that we would make a small change to the last sentence of Bullet B in paragraph 11, such that that sentence would read, the expected value may better predict the resolution of the uncertainty if there is a range of possible outcomes that are not binary and are not concentrated on one value, which would mean the drafting of that second sentence of Bullet B would be sort of the exact opposite of what is in Bullet A, and therefore hopefully make the distinction more clear. So with that, we would hand it over to the board for any discussions or comments on this interpretation.
Pichina, we use, you know, exact the same words in many other standards, and most likely and expected value. And the proposed changes in B, whether the same as in other standards, or there are some special meat for this purpose.
So this sort of, what I might call combination in the sense of most likely an amount expected value, how that has sort of been developed as part of this interpretation and is included in paragraph 11, it really only exists in that format before within IFRS 15. That's where the board first sort of introduced it in a sense. And it's in IFRS 15 in the context of measuring the amount of variable consideration when you're trying to work out what's the amount of the transaction price. Now, whilst the wording in IFRS 15, and I'm just going to open, I think it's paragraph 53, is very similar to this. This is sort of laid on, it's not word for word exactly the same, so this suggests a change we're making doesn't, for example, make this sort of, you know, contradict IFRS 15 or different from IFRS 15. I can tell you what IFRS 15 says. It is paragraph 53, by the way, of IFRS 15, which says, and so slightly different wording, what paragraph 53 of IFRS 15 says is it says that the most likely amount, and in this case may be an appropriate estimate of the amount of variable consideration, if the contract has only two possible outcomes, and it gives a for example, so it's sort of consistent with the binary notion here. What IFRS 15 says about expected value is the unexpected value may be an appropriate estimate of the amount, etc., if an entity has a large number of contracts with similar characteristics. So the words are not exactly the same to sort of start, but we hope that the suggested change certainly doesn't make it sort of different in a sense.
I think the words are quite different because in 15 you use the probability weighting, or it suggests using the probability weighting when there's a large number of different transactions. Whereas here, we're using expected value when there's a dispersion in the possible outcomes in one situation. And that seems to me to be quite different. My concern, I'm not objecting to what we're doing here, but my concern is I don't think we've ever really bottomed out on this expected value most likely issue. The words in 15, if I recall correctly, were a compromise with the FASB, because I think we had more in mind expected value, they were uncomfortable with that, and we ended up where we are. And I don't think it was ever really particularly satisfactory, because we've got this may in here, and we've got the may in this one. So is this a choice? And it seems very vague. So you may do the situation where you it may better predict in this situation. Well, that's not telling me when perhaps it may not be a better prediction. I just feel it's a where we've ended up with this. If this is going to be the standard wording or variance on this is the standard wording, perhaps we should have more of a fundamental debate and revisit this whole area of probability. I know we've had the paper before, which Joan did, but I just don't think we've ever really sorted this probability wording versus expected most likely outcome.
The way you read this, can I just check? Mm-hmm. Isn't, and I always feel nervous given it's so close to a standard that's already issued, but the way that I was reading this was to say you have to do the method which gives you the best prediction.
Yes.
So
that's your test, if you like.
Yes.
And that's either using either one of these methods. And I think of that most likely, the sentences about the most likely amount may be to me is almost like a, it's almost like basis to me or application guidance to help you think about how you'd go about making the determination. But I thought that the sort of way you'd read it would be you have to use the method which answers the question before you even get to the sub bullets.
Yes. Yeah. So exactly. So
it says may because it's sort of descriptive.
Yes, well, and it's just given an example kind of the size where it might be one or the other. So the requirement is in the lead-in about you reflecting the effect of uncertainty, depending on which method.
But what do we mean by prediction? Is it having the greatest chance that you'll hit on the exact number, or is it minimizing the variance between the number you have and the possible outcome? If it's a minimum variance, then I think it has to be an expected value in all situations. If it's maximizing the chance of landing on the correct number, then it should be the mode in all cases.
So what I would say in the context of IFRIC 23, which is in front of you for ratification, is that I suppose when the committee discussed and talked about this, and the basis reflects this in the census, they didn't, as far as I know, get into very significant discussion. Because I think what you're suggesting is at a sort of more whatever higher level in a sense, working out exactly the scenarios when we think using the expected value is kind of a better measurement, for use of better words, versus when might most likely might be a better measurement. I think they didn't go there that in a sense. What the basis explains is when they were thinking about kind of filling a gap in the requirements in a sense to think about how you deal with uncertainty. For income tax treatments, they very much looked at IFRS 15 and what had been done in IFRS 15 in the context of variable consideration.
And
I suppose, you know what I mean, and without sort of reinterrogating that in a sense.
And that's why I'm fine with it, because we've done it in 15, I think it's consistent, I don't think it's a problem. I'm just thinking for the future that we ought to have another rethink about expected value.
And I would just say that maybe if it gives you any comfort, what the committee has done on the basis is simply explained it in that way, that the sort of the idea or whatever the measurement they've come up with is similar to what's in IFRS 15, so they didn't go on to have any sort of wide discussion. Just one thing you did say is, as I hope that just that what I consider a small drafting change, I think, in bullet P hopefully brings it actually a bit closer to what's in IFRS 15, because we now talk about a range of possible outcomes. So I think that hopefully would tie in a bit more closely than what was there previously. I've mentioned widely dispersed.
Tom?
I can just follow up on that, because something I occasionally think about is what, I'm going to use the word expectation and sort of a Singlish sense about, you know, a prediction, a more generic. And, you know, you really have three choices in statistics. We've got two of them here, the mean, the mode, and the median would be the third, if you were going to say, what's our expectation? And what I was thinking when I read it is we've chosen a case. We've emphasized where we've talked about the expected value, the mean, we're doing it very much in a statistical sense, which is fine. For the mode one, we've thrown it in where we're using this binary distribution. But I was sort of thinking to myself, okay, well, what if the mode is one where 40% of the observations hit on the mode, and the mean's quite far? How do I read this to respond? So my mode's 50, that's 40%, and I've got some real outliers out there, and my mean's 100. It's neither of these real cases. It's not a nice distribution where the expected value is sitting tightly in the middle, and it's not a binary. And it's okay if we're leaving it to judgment, but I was just wondering, what are we trying to get at with this advice? And I think it goes, and it pops up in other places. A lot of times, I think where we choose the mode is zero. Quite often, we do nothing because 80% of the observations are zero or something.
I think that what is being suggested here is, as we said before, so the requirement comes in the intro. So I think there is, in your example where you're not very clearly hitting it, maybe the scenarios that are very explicitly mentioned in A and B, then there is judgment to be applied by entities in determining which of the methods, you know, it expects to better predict the resolution, you know, of this uncertainty with the tax authorities.
It be a between I support the revised wording, and as I reflect on it, I think Stephen's, I think at one level is right, you know, maybe an expected value versus most likely. Maybe at some point in time we should try to resolve them, but I don't think it's critical we do so now. I think 15 is a variable consideration, trying to estimate something that will work itself out. Here you're in the context of a tax authority examination, where you have an adversarial situation where you're, if not litigating, something similar to it. And I think the situations are very different. And if the words are slightly different, I think so be it. I just, other than they're both variable outcomes, the environmental circumstance is just so different, I wouldn't be too hung up on if the words are slightly different.
Mary?
Katrina, I have no problem with the drafting change that's proposed versus what had come to us originally from the interpretation committee. I think there's strength in making it mirror image, and I think there's no substantive change. So I kind of picked this paper up and put that aside. Going back to the draft interpretation that came, and the more general issue that we've been commenting on about these two alternatives identified in paragraph 11. I think the staff is focused on the immediate precedent in IFRS 15. There's also an earlier variant of it in IS 37, and what you might say is a more directly applicable analog, because it's how to measure a liability of uncertain amount. And I think that the comments we're hearing now are good points that we should incorporate when we activate the pipeline research project on IS 37. But given that we have some precedent in a couple of places in the standard, and the interpretations committee has worked through this already, I think unless it were a fundamental fatal flaw, we should not be looking to reopen it at this point. So. Okay, not just with the tweak in the drafting, but also with the interpretation committee's recommendation to finalize as is. Sorry, finalize with those two alternatives in, and then let's make a to-go note to incorporate in the pipeline project.
I've got another question, which might be more for Peter than the team. I note that there is no asymmetry in this document, and that if you have a most likely outcome and then the tail is negative on the sort of worse versus a most likely outcome and the tail, the distribution is on the positive side, we're making no statement in here about a different treatment, an asymmetrical treatment. Now we have in the conceptual framework a specific reference to asymmetry. I was curious as to how that applied.
Well, don't forget we said that asymmetry is not a qualitative characteristic of useful financial information. It might sometimes be an outcome of decisions the board has made on grounds of relevance and faithful representation.
So we're making the decision here that asymmetry should not apply in this situation.
It's neutral.
By implication, I suppose.
I think it's neutral by implication.
Which I think is a good outcome.
Yeah.
But
Steve, my understanding on the asymmetrical things in conceptual framework is, you know, unless it's so necessary, otherwise we should not touch. Because otherwise, every time we discuss any scenarios, any measurement, we'll think about whether we should have symmetrical or not. This is why I said, unless they're so necessary, otherwise, there's no need for us to generate a problem for ourselves.
I agree. I'm out of.
Thanks. Just to I agree with staff's proposal, and I agree with Mary that it's not really wise for us to reopen this. But I'd just like to voice that my preference would be only to have the expected value. I really don't think it would be necessary in this particular case to have the most likely amount included as an option. I think it's a little bit of a rules-based and creates more problems than resolve. So my personal preference would be not to follow the options that are in IFRS 15 and have only expected value, in short, but I have no objection to go ahead. I still think expected value would provide the answer, especially in this particular circumstance.
So, do we agree to rectify? Yes. Okay. Post ballot.
On to 12B. Move to 12B, yeah.
Okay.
Okay, now let's move on to agenda paper 12B, which discusses the proposed amendments to IS-28, which were included in the 2015-17 Annual Improvements Exposure Draft. A summary of the issue and the proposed amendments are described in paragraphs 5 to 8. The board received 50 comment letters. Main issues identified raised by respondents relate to A, reconsideration of the proposed amendments, and B, further clarifications, including an illustrative example. Paragraphs 12 to 17 summarizes feedback relating to reconsideration of the proposed amendments, and our analysis on this issue is included in paragraphs 18 to 25. When developing the proposed amendments, the board and the committee discussed many of the concerns raised. While aware of these concerns, the board decided not to reconsider the accounting for long-term interest because the board noted that any such reconsideration could not be undertaken as a narrow-scope project. We continue to think that any reconsideration of accounting for long-term interest is beyond the scope of this project and would be best addressed as part of a wider project. We also think that clarifying the existing requirements in the meantime is a practical way to address the diversity in views. Consequently, we recommend reaffirming the proposed amendments to IS-28 to clarify that IFRS 9 applies to long-term interests. Question 1 on page 7 asks whether you agree with this recommendation. Now I'll hand over to you for discussion.
Doug.
Thank you. I disagree. I think as long as long-term interest is subject to the loss allocation, it is already a part of equity method. This is because the outcome of accounting is all the same. Suppose, so let's take example in the, say for example in the appendix B. So 200 is just ordinary share and accounting for equity method, and 100 for the preference share and 100 for loans. But assume total 400 are accounted for equity method, then accounting outcome itself is all the same. And in your paragraph 7, you are saying that we are only considering, IS 28 is only considering the loss side, but for the upper side, it's all the same. We don't have to mention it in the IS 28, because as long as it's upper side, then all you have to recognize is 40% share of the profit or loss of the investee. So therefore, we could say that in the broader sense of equity method, IS 28 covers long-term interest as well. So therefore, I disagree with the staff's recommendation.
I agree with the staff's recommendation to reaffirm the amendments to clarify that 9 applies to the long-term interests. As you know, I think that was the plan when we designed the expected credit loss model to apply to these types of instruments, and it's just an interpretation question. I certainly agree that longer term we may want to look at the interaction between these standards in the context of the equity method more broadly, but I don't think it's the time now. I think it's the time now to give people certainty so they can get on and apply IFRS 9.
Who agrees with the staff recommendation?
Everyone except one.
Okay.
The next issue we'd like to discuss relates to further clarification, including an illustrative example. Paragraph 26 summarizes feedback on this issue, and our analysis is included in paragraphs 27 to 33. On the basis of our analysis, we recommend that the board clarify in IS 28 that A, an entity applies IFRS 9 to long-term interest before any of the requirements in IS 28, and in applying, and B, in applying IFRS 9, the entity does not take account of any adjustments to the carrying amount of long-term interest that result from the application of IS 28. We also recommend developing educational material that would include an illustrative example along the lines of the example outlined in Appendix B to this paper. Question 2 on page 10 asks whether you agree with these recommendations. And up to you for a discussion.
Thank you again. I disagree with the staff recommendation. The reason is same as my dissent opinion. And actually, this amendment would force entities what we call dual application. So of course, the double accounting is a problem, but before that, the dual application is a serious problem. As you said in the paragraph C12, IFRS 9 and IS 28 has a different objective. I agree, but if the objective is different, then entities should apply either IFRS 9 or IS 28, but not both. That is the problem. And if you look at the Appendix B, it comes with a good example number. So the original investment is 400, as I explained. It's 200 ordinary share, 100 preference share, and the 100 loans. So then the loss for the total, the loss of the investee is if we count the 40% of the loss of the investee, it's only 260. Because if you look at the table on the page 22, period one is profit 50, period two is loss 200, so period three is loss 500. So in total, cumulative loss is 650. So 40% is only 26. But if you look at page 26 table, and if you look at period three in the lower table, then the net investment balance is 40, whereas original investment are the 400. So only the loss proportion is 260. Why the net investment amount decrease as to only 40? I don't think it is a faithful representation of the economy. And suppose total 400 was all equity investment, then the net investment amount of period three would be 140. And suppose, 400 are all loan, then if the impairment ratio was 50, then it should be 200. But once you apply both IAS 28 and IFRS 9, which has a different objective, to one asset, then the outcome would be only 40. And I don't understand why. So I think it's really overkilling, because we are not addressing the overlapping portion and applying different concept standard to one asset. And that is what we shouldn't do. Therefore, I disagree with staff's recommendation.
I agree with the staff's recommendation to clarify this, because I think it's been difficult for us and the Interpretations Committee, let alone the outside world, to understand how the mechanics work. And I think that it would be helpful for people to have an illustration that shows them how these mechanics work, because unless you're a real geek, it's quite a lot of different concepts to think through, so I think it's helpful. In terms of the educational material, I'm a little bit torn on location, because the thing that does worry me a little bit with the educational material is visibility. So while I can see why it's a bit of a long example and it's a bit odd because there's not any other example in 28, I worry a little bit about visibility. Having said that, I'm happy for it to be educational material, but I'm hoping that our new website, when it's launched, will make these things easier for people to find.
I also support the staff recommendation, but only because it goes with the objective of clarification. And I also support that the example is provided, because you can understand the words, but it's in a way so counterintuitive that you need the example to make sure you have read well.
And I think I'll just reiterate that point, of course, that went through the whole discussions, is that to me, we haven't created this. This would be different if we were creating, if we'd gone through a process of rediscussing and thinking what is the best accounting for these things. And at this point, all we said we tried to do quite quickly, given, the effective date of IFRS 9, was simply clarify what is already there, but then potentially, actually relook and reconsider whether, we thought that was the best accounting or not. But we just thought that wasn't something that could be done narrowly. It would be done as part of a wider project.
No, I also agree with staff. And the only question I have, I questioned myself, was about education as well as Sue. I think I would ask staff to think, how can we make this as visible as possible, considering the because the clarification that you are proposing 27D is almost an additional issue, an additional point to 27A. So is that we are going a little bit further, and maybe the clarification is enough, and then the education material is of less importance in the standard itself. But I think the education material, we should find a way to really make it visible to people as soon as possible, as soon as the amendment is published. Just think about that, please.
Yeah.
Mary?
Also, I'm supportive of the staff proposal. I wanted to make one comment, though, Petrina, sparked in part by the observation you made about the focus is on clarification of I4S9 rather than re-deliberation. To me, it's not just what was possible to do in the time before the effective date of I4S9, which certainly informed how rapidly, you know, how we prioritized it. But to me, the issues, the concerns that Tak has raised, and I think some that Françoise has pointed to, are really ones that go back to the equity method itself. And even if we had more time right now, I would not want to look at this slice of the equity method without looking at the equity method as a whole, because I think it's one of those things which, as soon as we start to pick a piece out, that there will be many others. So I'll go back and look at the language here. I think the timeliness, the issue about the effective date of I4S9 might prompt us to accelerate finalizing it the way, you know, the subsequent question the staff is asking. But I think I'd like to leave a clear message that the prompt for not stepping back and saying, how do we start again and think through the accounting for these things is the broader project on equity method. Again, I think pipeline research.
Françoise.
Yeah, I wanted to add about the example. I think the minimum we should have is a reference in the Green Book to something that exists.
Yeah.
Because you would not go to the website to find something you don't know is there, but you're going to go because you have been told there is something to see.
Put a flag in the Green Book.
Yeah. I mean, maybe we can be, sorry, I was going to use the word creative. I don't mean creative. We can just maybe, I don't mean create stuff. but more just, I mean, I just note visibility and also, Françoise, your comment about the Green Book. So I think that we can just, you know, when we're developing this, just think about how we get as much visibility as possible, which might include a reference in the Green Book, you know, look at the location on the website.
Just to balance the Green Book discussion, do we ever refer in the Green Book to material that is not part of our normal public discourse and publication and the likes? Because the problem with it is that if we make a reference to it and then withdraw it at some point for whatever reason, and it's referred to in the Green Book, it's not part of the public record elsewhere. So I just make sure we explore that and just make sure it's
okay.
Consistent. Or
protect for a final offensive.
Oh, yeah. Before final offensive, just referring to the education, I think it should be part of the bound volume. Otherwise, it would be prominent, and it will be lost as time goes on. So I think it should be included in the bound volume anyway. And with respect to this balance, so those of you who agreed with staff recommendation, I sincerely would like to ask, do you really think the net investment balance on the period 40 is the right answer? Do you seriously think it's 40 is the right answer to faithfully represent the economy of this situation? So only the fact we know is this company has a loss of 650. If we don't have any other information, and the any other information is only impairment ratio is about 50%, then how come you can conclude that the balance of the net investment is only 40? How can you justify it? If you could persuade me, it should be justified in this way. This 40 is the right answer.
I don't think we're going to persuade you today, Tak, but yeah. I think we're saying that's a question for another day. We're not saying it's not a valid question, we're just saying not today.
Yeah, so in this sense, then, we are clarifying that our standard is wrong.
Question, not error. Question.
Oh, that's a very important step.
Okay. Just a moment. Sorry. I forgot one.
Last note you're going to have.
Is there any possibility that we can think of the style of lower? Because we can calculate the equity method, the outcome is 140, and the impairment only method outcome is 200, then we can compare, and then in that case lower amount is 140, then we can use 140 rather than 40, because you know if we choose the lower of, so it's not it's already prudent, and there wouldn't be any overlap. That's practically possible. So why don't we do that?
Not today.
Not today.
Okay.
You can try again tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
Who supports the staff recommendation?
Okay, that's everyone except one.
All right.
Okay, thank you, please. Questions?
Effective date.
Next, we'd like to discuss the effective date and transition together, since these are very much linked. The board proposed an effective date of 1st January 2018, so that entities could use the transition requirements in IFRS 9 when they first apply IFRS 9 and the amendments to long-term interest. Paragraph 36 to 39 summarize feedback on the proposed effective date, and analysis is included in paragraphs 40 to 43. On the basis of analysis, on balance, we recommend an effective date of 1st January 2019 with early application permitted. However, there are consequences of a 2019 effective date on transition. The board proposed retrospective application of the proposed amendments. The board also proposed relief from restating comparative information if an entity does not restate when it first applies IFRS 9. The board proposed similar transition requirements for insurers applying the temporary exemption from IFRS 9 and first-time adopters. Paragraph 46 summarizes feedback on the proposed transition requirements and analysis included in paragraphs 47 to 52. If the board sets an effective date 2018, we recommend the board to reaffirm the proposed transition requirements. On the other hand, if the board sets an effective date 2019, we recommend requiring retrospective application of the amendments and also providing specific transition requirements similar to those included in IFRS 9 regarding the classification and measurement of financial assets. Question 3 on page 13 and question 4 on page 16 ask whether you agree with the recommendations.
Sue?
Yes, overall I do agree. I just wanted to confirm a couple of things with you if I could on the transition. So firstly on the business model, so for the people who come along subsequent to when they first applied IFRS 9 to everything else, they'd only be assessing the business model in respect of the assets that are coming in from 28, right? They're not assessing the business model for all their old stuff again. And on the restatement, the choice of not being required to restate comparative information. So if we'd only end up then, would we, with a combination of people who are applying still in their comparative information, IAS 28 to the instruments, if they'd chosen not to restate, or IFRS 9 to the instruments if they had chosen to restate. Anybody who had applied 39 before will have moved to 9.
Yes, from 2018.
From 2018. So they. Yep. So it's only going to be a combination of 28 and 9, no 39 people left.
That's right. That's right. Because if you're, just to make clear, because
if you're in 39, you were already in the FI literature, so you don't get to wait.
Okay.
And then the last question was the reliefs for impairment would apply, so the transition reliefs in IFRS 9 for assessing impairment would apply to these guys as well, so it's all the reliefs would apply to them.
All the relevant ones, I think was our thinking, which would definitely would include those for impairment.
Mary?
I have a follow-up to the first of Sue's questions in respect to paragraph 50, which is, Sue confirmed with you that this the assessment of the business model at the not early adoption date is only in respect of the business model in which the former IS 28 items are held. My question is, what is the business model holding the IS 20, you know, former IS 28 investments? Is it a business model that was just assessed and holds assets other than the IS 28 assets? Should this relief in paragraph 50 apply only if it's held in a separate business model, not holding other IFRS non-assets?
I assume, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that, so for example, if I have a business model, I've got assets that were already, I'd already applied 39 to, and I'd already transitioned to 9, and I'd assess my business model.
Model for the adoption of IFRS.
For all of that in 2018. I come along in 29, and for whatever reason, there are some of these long-term interests that I hadn't applied 39, therefore I hadn't applied 9 to in 2018. To me, I'd look at it, and if those long-term interests amount, say, fit within, you would look at the business model in the sense that that fits within, and then you would simply, so you're not changing your previous business model assessment for all of the other instruments that you've already applied 9 to. You're just looking at any of those long-term interests that you potentially, you had just been applying IS 28 to and assessing what business model they fit into.
I'd agree with what Trina said based on my understanding of her answer to me, and what I would analogise to is if I've got an existing business model and I assessed it in 2018, then whenever I buy new assets that go into that business model, technically speaking, every time I recognise that new asset, I'm assessing the business model again because it's initial recognition. What that means in theory is that the business model can change over time. It doesn't cause the original assets to be reclassified, but you're thinking about business model new every time you recognise a new asset. And to me, that's exactly the same as what we're doing here. So it has no implications for the old classifications, but in theory, you could have a business model that's morphed over time, so it could be a different assessment outcome than it was originally for that same group of assets.
It's very helpful to have that extra nuance articulated about the ongoing assessment made, as it were, I'll say prospectively, but I'm using that with red blinking lights for caution.
I mean, if the board obviously agrees to go this route, it might be something that's worth actually spelling out in the transition.
I think in the basis of it's worth explaining.
All right. Can we support the staff's recommendation?
Will we start with effective date?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking,
basically. Everybody agrees.
And then question 4, transition requirements.
Yes. Okay, so all except one.
Okay.
Okay, that was all.
That's all.
Okay, sorry, we need one more question.
Okay. So lastly, Appendix A to this paper summarizes other matters raised, along with the analysis and recommendations. Do you have any comments on any of the matters included in Appendix A?
I agree with the staff's analysis of the responses. It did strike me that item 6 might be worth picking up in the basis. Just a comment about why that wasn't added, and I was a little puzzled about why, in effect, comment 2 wasn't answered by the educational material example. But again, I agree with the staff analysis that none of these raise a question about the proposals or need to be addressed in the amendment itself.
Just the final thing that isn't a question that I was just going to mention is obviously in the paper in paragraphs 53 and 54 we mentioned that, giving the sort of more urgency around this issue that we would intend to pull this out in a sense from the other annual improvements and move it forward as a sort of separate narrow scope amendment. So I just wanted to mention that in case anybody objected, but otherwise that's what we planned to do.
Okay.